You know, a conversation about Noah last hour when we were doing open lines made me reflect back on the oldest human beings, right? Because according to the Bible, Noah was 950 years old or something when he died. And that made me think of Methuselah and then some of the other biblical figures that were supposed to be very old. And so I was just looking up oldest people. Just real quickly during the break at the top of the hour, and came across, first of all, an interesting fact that the lists of oldest human beings, whether it's oldest beings that have ever lived or are currently living, is dominated by Americans. I only offer that to you in reflection on healthcare issues and, you know, meat eating and other things that Americans are well represented in the list of oldest human beings, male, female, whatever. And then it made me think, well, why haven't we ever done a show where we just had somebody on the air who was 113 years old? I mean, what do they remember? What do they experience? It suddenly makes me want to look into that. What's the oldest person we can find who could still have a conversation in the middle of the night on Coast to Coast? Maybe they're out there somewhere. In the meantime, we'll just have to think about the origins of the universe and humankind and all of the accumulated knowledge that exists out there through the book, The Secret Doctrine. Madame Blavatsky is both the subject of the book and also the writer of the book that was been recently condensed by our guest, Michael Gomes, who abridged and annotated The Secret Doctrine. We'll understand her mysteriousness, and we will reveal the answers to the mysteries of the universe next, according to Madame Blavatsky on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, besides being a writer and an editor on his own, the book, The Secret Doctrine by Madame Blavatsky, is handled very well by Michael Gomes. He's a librarian for the New York Lodge of the Theosophical Society. And as I understand it, Michael, it'd be fair to describe you as a theosophical historian?
Yes.
How many of them are there in the United States, theosophical historians?
Probably you could count them on one hand.
It's a small convention, isn't it?
When
you guys get together. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed your work on this book, and we'll talk more about that coming up in just a second. I think it's important for us to set the table, though, for the work of Madame Helena Blavatsky to talk about who she was first, as she's sort of a name that's sort of emblematic, but people don't necessarily know the true story behind the woman, or will we ever know the whole true story behind the woman?
Good point, Ian. We definitely know she came to America in July 1873. Before that, it's pretty well hearsay in a blank, but we start having definite records, correspondence, diary, she starts getting mentioned. So we know she comes in July 1873. She starts this Theosophical Society in 1875 here in New York, and then, of course, writes her major book, Isis Unveiled, which is 1877. And after that, as soon as she gets her American citizenship in 1878, she goes to India, where she spends 5 years.
But where she came from, is it the Ukraine? Is that confirmed that's the place of her birth?
Today it would be Ukraine. It was then, of course, southern Russia. It's a small town called Ekaterinoslav, which was in the rural, very rural. She comes from sort of the lesser nobility of that area. Her grandmother is a princess. Her father is a captain in the army, and her mother is actually a very well-known writer, a very well-known Russian writer for her time.
What did her mother write, Madame Blavatsky's mom write?
Fiction, and also about women. At a time when you know, there wasn't too much about women may being the heroine or discussing or deciding the events in a novel.
And so you could say then she was raised perhaps with sort of a feminist perspective before there was a name to it, and an encouragement for her to be the heroine of her own story.
Possibly. You know, her mother died when she was 11. She lived with her father a lot, who was a captain, and of course he was constantly being transferred in the army. She was sort of an army brat, great horseback woman, loved to ride horses, adventurous, strong will. So yes, perhaps some of that is in there because of the great freedom she had.
What do we know of Madame Blavatsky's early education? First of all, Blavatsky is her married name,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So at what age does she get married?
17, on the eve of her 18th birthday.
And she marries a guy named Blavatsky.
Yes.
How did that marriage work out?
This, again, is one of those lacunas that we really are not clear about. Some say that she marries old General Blavatsky, who is governor of the province of Ervion, which is now modern Armenia. Imagine, her husband is the governor of Armenia.
Okay.
And some say she married him just to get away from her maternal grandparents, where she was sent after her mother died, very strict Greek Orthodox. There's this mystery, but whatever we know is that she took that name and literally within a few months left her husband and began a life of world travel.
Okay, so she marries the dude and then splits on him?
Pretty well.
Okay, so we know that that whatever it was, it wasn't working for her, but it was enough to liberate her from her household.
Exactly.
And is that why she has to leave then? If she leaves him, she can't stay in the country where he's governor. That would be awkward.
That would be awkward, of course, just like today. And she was being sent back to her grandparents, and she bribes the ship captain. She goes then to Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. Imagine a 17-year-old girl who just decides she's just going to get away from it all and go who knows where.
And so, well, what does she have to lose? You know, if she's right, if she's married a guy, if we don't know a lot about the marriage, and we think maybe it was an arranged or an escaped marriage, might as well just keep escaping. So, all right. So she gets to Constantinople, and then from there, she moves through Europe, but we don't know a lot about her education at this point, do we?
Probably she had the typical education for a well-brought-up Russian girl at that time, which was she would have learned French, she would have learned etiquette, she would have learned how to play the piano, of course, reading. But that's just about it. You know, there was really no purpose to educate a woman at that time.
Well, she wouldn't have learned English, though.
She had governess who supposedly spoke English when she was very young. But the governess came from Yorkshire, which is, if you know the movie My Fair Lady, the accent that Audrey Hepburn has is a Yorkshire accent, that sort of A accent,
right.
You know. So she did pick up some when she was young. And then she claims that in London in 1851, they have this great exhibition at the Crystal Palace, covers the entire of Hyde Park. And she says that she sees this Indian who's come with the Nepal delegation, and he tells her about, you know, the mystic East. And she decides to go. Again, as you say, what else does she have to lose?
Right. So at some point then, at a young age, she makes a trip to Asia somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. Talk about her early Asian travels as opposed to the ones she makes later on in life.
Again, very difficult because we just sort of don't have any records. The awkward thing about her is wherever she goes, somebody meets her, she makes an impression on somebody, there is something in the papers. People tend to recollect, especially after she dies. You know, after she dies, it's really world news. And everybody seems to come out of the woodwork who knows her. But that period is really what they call the veil years. Supposedly, she got as far as Tashi Lumpo in Tibet, which is the seat, the monastery of the Panchen Lama, who is only second to the Dalai Lama in Tibet. She goes there, supposedly, spends time there, comes back, goes to Russia again, and then goes back again to India. But as I say, finally, by the 1870s, we start getting some accurate information about her.
Well, and I'm not casting aspersions here, but I'm curious, how did she pay for this? I mean, that wasn't free back then. So what was her source of her income, do you think?
She says that her father sent her some sort of remittances. But I would think, say, a century and almost a half ago, life was really much cheaper. People also were much more hospitable to people. So she would have really needed a little to travel around with.
Okay.
Yeah, these are all, it's blank we have that there's a lot of hearsay, and I don't want to give your audience who's really, on top of things to give them sort of hearsay evidence, or maybe we don't know, or a guess. I want to give you the facts.
Yeah, we're good with hearsay. So don't worry. It's okay. Because I think when it comes to the historical record, especially when it comes to a mysterious figure like her, whether in the end the hearsay rises to the level of fact, we can leave it up to folks to make that judgment for themselves. But at what point is she being called Madame Blavatsky?
Probably when she first comes to New York. She suddenly starts, as soon as she comes, she makes the papers. She meets the Civil War colonel, Henry Steele Olcott, who forms the Theosophical Society with her. He is a prominent New York lawyer, and he introduces her to the press in real glowing terms. It seems that at that time in America, spiritualism was rampant. It was really a big movement.
Sure.
It pops up in literature. It pops up in the Times. But it seems that Colonel Olcott went to a Vermont farmhouse to test these mediums, these Eddie mediums, who were giving this full form materialization. Not the sort of spiritualism we know of, whether it's just a rap or someone is channeling, but a full form of the departed individual would appear during these seances. And Colonel Olcott thought, if this is true, it's really something that's worth investigating.
And yet we know that according to the historical record that I know of, and I've been very interested in this particular period, we see it reflected even in our political history. To what degree did Mary Todd Lincoln fall under the influence of spiritualists? And therefore, how much influence was exerted on Abraham Lincoln as a result of spiritualism? And there was a lot of fraud going on at that time.
Yes, very true.
And especially when it came to this so-called spirit photography in the early days of photography. And there's whole books on all of the chicanery that was going on. So I'd be curious about those full body, images in the barn. But that having been said. Right. I mean, I would, because I think we know that.
Well, also, Colonel Olcott was sort of no naive or gullible fool. This is a man who was an investigator for the U.S. War Department. He was sent to Washington as part of the Lincoln assassination investigation.
Oh, really?
He actually sent up to Vermont, which must have been an arduous trip to go from New York City to rural Vermont, a scale to weigh these forms. He measured. In fact, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of, the arch detective Sherlock Holmes, actually writes that he says that actually he thinks there are very few things he can think of that Colonel Olcott didn't do to try to test these mediums. So, yes, it's these awkward things that, it's this awkward background that she comes out of. But I must tell you, after about a year watching this stuff, she really distances herself from spiritualism.
Yeah, and I think that may be an indicator to us that there was something going on that she didn't want to equate with what she was doing. Madame Blavatsky then becomes sort of known as Madame Blavatsky when she comes to America, and then from that point forward. But what had made her famous so that this Civil War colonel would have had knowledge of her before she even arrived?
Well, no, until they met, he really didn't know of her.
Okay.
He was covering these things for the New York papers. It seems that it was so popular, it was literally a weekly series in the New York Daily Graphic, and the issue sold out, and she supposedly went there to make his acquaintance. And so they meet in 1874. I think the exact date is October 14th, 1874. And it starts up this acquaintance between them.
I don't know what you're doing right with your phone right now, but don't move. Because before we were getting kind of a scratchy line, and I'm afraid we lose sometimes the sound of it. And I think we're at the bottom of the hour. we'll try messing with your line a little bit because you're very clear in spurts. So freeze. Michael Gomes is the editor and the person who does the annotations for this new book called The Secret Doctrine. So she moves to, we know she goes to London. Then we know that in the 1850s, she travels to Asia. We don't know exactly where or what she does. What do we think she's after in the 1850s, before she comes originally to the U.S.?
She makes contact, according to her own claims. This Indian has told her that there is this school in the Himalayas with people from different nationalities who are studying this sort of esoteric background, a common universality of all religions. This quest, perhaps it's just the quest, the same pilgrimage that in turn lures anyone to the East today.
I'm going to ask you a weird question, but as you know, somebody who is both a biographer of her and perhaps as a student of that period, what kind of clothes is she wearing then? Is she a conventional European lady? Does she travel differently than other women did in her time?
During that time, she says she traveled a lot in men's clothes.
That's what I wondered about.
Yeah, just for convenience, because, at that time, a single woman could not check into a hotel by herself. So she probably found more freedom traveling as a man. She certainly didn't get herself into the bustles and corsets and those sort of things of that time period.
But the bustles and corsets later on is what we associate with her, that great photograph that's on the cover of the book. And she was, she had, at least later in her life, the image of the European heiress of a look to her. But that didn't surprise me. I didn't know the answer to that, so I was curious. So she's traveling as a man, perhaps checking into hotels as a man, and she's bucking convention everywhere she goes.
Yeah.
And so she makes it to the monastery that she's pursuing. And she wants to find the sort of the nexus between all of the world's religions. What do they have in common? And then perhaps by finding that commonality, finding truth. Was there anything else that she was looking for?
I think you pretty well covered it. This quest, because with her, knowledge is power. She wrote these fast books. The Secret Doctrine in its original is over 1,500 pages. And with her, it's a form of yoga in India that's known as jhana yoga, which is jhana being knowledge. The truth will set you free.
Right.
And so I think she comes from this background that if you know the truth, that you will become sort of enlightened. You will get some insight into the whole working of the cosmos.
As she appears to you in history, let me apologize in advance, but I have a deep curiosity about her. Are there romances along the way? Does she make connections with famous people in her life story?
As far as romances, we're really, again, not sure. There are all of these rumors that she had an illegitimate child, that she traveled with a opera singer in Europe. But again, there's not that substantiation. It's sort of still hearsay. I know that when a prominent New York newspaper, the New York Sun, published these allegations against her, she sued the paper for libel, claiming she could not have had a child and saying that it was going to be backed up by a doctor's certificate of this.
Hmm. And did she win in the lawsuit against the New York Sun?
Unfortunately, she died before the case could come to court, and in New York law at that time dismissed the case. But the paper did publish a retraction claiming that there was sort of no basis for these stories.
Interesting.
Actually, they republished a full-page story about her, even though she died.
And they were trying to sort of smudge her name by saying that she had a child out of wedlock.
Which would have been, the big sin in 19th century. The most shocking, you were probably, the scarlet letter.
Yes, exactly. Well, yeah. So that's where we'll leave the story of Madame Blavatsky for the time being, but we'll come right back. The Secret Doctrine, Michael Gomes is the editor and the guy who we'll talk to about What is in the secret doctrine? What are the secrets that she collected? And we'll finish the timeline a little bit of her story on how it is that she comes to the United States, and then once she's established here as a resident, then she leaves again. And that's where the secret doctrine begins on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're a ways yet from getting to your questions, but I want you to keep track of them as we go along here in our conversation with Michael Gomes, who set off on his own to try to track down the truth about Madame Blavatsky. And that's what brought him to the secret doctrine. What is in the secret doctrine? What does it say about the origins of the universe and of us as human beings? And all of the secrets will be revealed if you've never investigated it. You will tonight. It's the woman who is still probably the best known esoteric, the best known mystic of these secret teachings. And we'll get to the story of her as she came across in her last trip around the world. She finally all came together for her in such a way, in such a profound way, that it almost killed her. We'll tell you about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Michael Gomes was just telling us about the story of Madame Helena Blavatsky. And so let's pick this up. So we know she travels. She eventually, at some point, she applies to come to the United States to become a resident. When does that happen?
She arrives in 1873.
No, when does she apply? She's in Europe and she decides she wants to move to America?
Yeah, suddenly she's in Paris and she says one day she just gets up and decides to come. And of course, in those days, you really didn't have to apply as just a tourist or a visa. Things were much less stringent than they are today. And when she came here, she decided to become an American citizen. And so 1873, she must have applied at the end of it. And by 1878, she gets her citizenship.
So it did take a while for her to get her citizenship.
Yeah, it's usually 5 years, even today. I'm not sure.
Right. Well, that's what I was sort of getting at. And it's after she gets her citizenship that what happens?
She then leaves for India. And, of course, that starts a different chapter. We can say, you know, there's a whole American chapter of her here. She goes to India. And then, of course, after that goes to Europe, where she writes The Secret Doctrine.
Waiting 5 years is probably because you couldn't, if you're waiting to get citizenship, you can't, after you've applied for citizenship, you can't leave until you get it?
I think you have to be a resident.
Right. Yeah. So once you get it, then she knows from now on she's going to be a U.S. citizen. She takes off back to Asia. Where does she go this time?
She arrives in Bombay with Colonel Olcott. And then from there, they travel throughout Asia. The lodges of the Theosophical Society start springing up all across that continent, and especially in Sri Lanka. Colonel Olcott is actually quite famous in Sri Lanka. He is the person who started schools for Buddhist children. And he actually, there is a statue of him in Colombo. And they did a stamp for him. You know, it's 2007 was the centenary of his passing.
And they did a stamp for him in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah.
A Civil War general.
You know, yeah, imagine. And here is, you know, they say that Colonel Olcott, he traveled everywhere. They said he was probably sort of the first white man that a lot of these people saw who was actually sympathetic to them instead of telling them, you know, they're heathens, right. You're going to burn, you got to convert, your ways are,
wrong. Yeah. Right. He's not the great white father.
Yeah. You know, it's ironic because before Olcott and Blavatsky go to India with this idea of finding spirituality, nobody in their right mind would have gone there. India is the black hole of Calcutta. It's a place you send missionaries to. You know, you convert the heathen. But the idea of going there for spirituality would sort of be absurd. The great Orientalists of the time had never even been to India. They translated texts in Europe.
But I thought that was already on the way to becoming part of the British Empire, if it wasn't already.
Yes,
India.
Yes, certainly.
Okay, so there were lots of British people that were reforming the country in the image of the British Empire.
Yes. Okay. But I don't think are very sympathetic because, you know, in 1857, the Indians mutinied, Nowadays, the Indians call it the First War of Independence. It's an interesting perspective. And after that, the relations between the Indians and the British were really distant.
You know, right.
It wasn't a mutual.
Right. You know, it was a very classist kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Okay, but, all right. So, and we are not to believe that there was a romance between Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Olcott.
No, I don't think so. He referred to her as his chum. Colonel Olcott had been married, and before she came on the scene, he had divorced his wife. It was sort of one of those marriages that they both decided it was, you know, time for to be separated.
So they go to India, and what do we think she's after specifically this time?
They travel all throughout India, and as I say, all of these lodges of the Theosophical Societies spring up everywhere. You know, at that time, India is not the unified country we think today. There are princely states. There are some parts controlled by the British. There are still parts that are still French, like Pondicherry and Goa. And yet, with their travels, they create this idea of this thing called India that didn't really exist before. There's a lot of separate states, and, you know, it wasn't this unified. They say the Theosophical Society was the first all-India organization. And they start probing Eastern scripture, comparing it, finding that commonality with Western scriptures. And this is, you know, I think one of their big contributions. And in turn, through her books, people in the West start getting an echo of what Eastern philosophy is, or this esoteric philosophy.
And so they're both sort of picking up and putting down. They're putting down roots for the Theosophical Society, and they're picking up new information that's adding to the Theosophical movement.
Yes.
Okay. So in a way, they haven't experienced, if you'll pardon the kind of the biblical way of understanding this, they haven't experienced the full revelation of the doctrine.
Well, supposedly Madame Blavatsky claims she herself did, because she's taught, you know, by these teachers, these Mahatmas, godlike figures, who actually Colonel Olcott says he met physically in India. This is the thing with her teachers that makes it different from spiritualism. They aren't sort of astral shapes or disincarnate individuals. These are actually living human beings who she claims through self-purification and their own study have perfected those innate talents in every individual.
Okay, wait. But what I'm saying is that she is still learning things about that are going to go into the secret doctrine when she's in this tour of India sometime in the latter half of the 19th century.
Yes, in the 1880s.
Okay. Right. So she's putting down Theosophical Societies as they go across the subcontinent, but they are also learning things from these other masters, because it's only at a certain, like, it's like a breaking point, it seems, in her story when she has to write it all down. I mean, it seems like she's sort of overwhelmed by it at the point that they travel back to Europe. Would that be an unfair way to describe it?
Somewhat, but you know, in 1877, she had published her first book, Isis Unveiled, which I've also abridged a decade ago. And in it, and that's 1,400 pages, one volume titled Science, the second volume titled Theology, where she looks at the origins of Christianity, for instance. She's one of the first people to start mentioning the Gnostics as a source, and considering at the time there was really nothing. I think there was just one book published on Gnosticism at that time. So she looks at she refers to the early Christianities, that there were a number of groups, and of course then one becomes the dominant idea.
Right. But she gets to Europe after the India trip, and this is where she writes the secret doctrine.
She sits down, imagine. She leaves in disgrace because this in London, this Society for Psychical Research has started a committee to investigate all of this phenomenon, all of these things, and they publish a report in 1885 saying that she is sort of one of the greatest frauds in history. Interestingly, the person who does the investigation says she didn't do it because of financial gain. She didn't do it for notoriety. His conclusion is she did all of this as a cover for her being a Russian spy.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, you know, sort of a 200-pound woman, you know, sitting down to write 1,500-page books is like a really good cover if you're spying.
Okay, but let's go back on that a little bit. So why would what had she done already other than writing the ISIS Unveiled? What was it that she had done that got her in the crosshairs of this Society for Psychical Research?
Well, one of her things is producing phenomena. For instance, there's what a great example is. She's in Shimla in North India, which is where, you know, the British government goes every summer because of the heat. And while they're going out on a picnic, and a person comes who is not expected. So they're all on a picnic. And he says to her, well, you know, why don't you produce a teacup? And she says, okay, where? And lo and behold, they discover a teacup, you know, buried in the roots in the trees. So it's things like that that draws this attention of this group. And, of course, they simply claim that it's all a gigantic fraud.
That she had somebody come up to her and say...
She sort of anticipated this, had somebody go out in the woods, bury a teacup in the, you know, in between, that sort of thing. And so it was all... Her phenomena were not real. They don't look at... the philosophy itself. They don't really touch that. And then, of course, there is this remarkable amount of material called the Mahatma Letters, which are in the British Museum. This is about 144 letters from her teachers to a Mr. A.P. Sinnett, who ran sort of the leading paper, English paper in India called The Pioneer. And it's full of philosophy and back and forth between them. And, of course, Hodgson claims, the person who did the report for the Society for Psychical Research, claims that it was all done by her in a disguised handwriting.
So she was writing back and forth to herself? Is that the claim?
Sort of, you would think, right?
Well, I mean, is that the claim? Is that,
she is actually, there are no Mahatmas, these teachers aren't real, and it's just a put-up job, and so she's writing all of this material.
Now, what leads you to wonder or believe that that's not true?
First of all, the handwriting experts who have looked at it, we have three main cases. One, Hodgson himself was no handwriting expert. It's interesting, when he sent the samples to London, the person at the British Museum claimed they weren't written by Madame Blavatsky, and Hodgson, who had decided his theory before leaving, said, kept sending him material till he actually changed his opinion, which is sort of not good science. But at the time, a German member sends copies of these Mahatma letters to the court calligraph of the court of Germany. He says it's not her. Then in the 1960s, a engineer in California, Victor Endesby, sends them to the University of California that had a crime lab at that time. They say it's not them. And then recently, a book has been published actually through the Society for Psychical Research by Vernon Harrison, one of their longtime members who is an expert witness in England on handwriting and forgery, that she definitely was not the author of those letters. So we have this massive material running hundreds of pages, and the quandary is, you know, who then wrote them? Who, if she is the author, then she's even a greater phenomena than we imagine.
Okay, so interesting. So here you have Madame Blavatsky, who now she's being investigated already for being a fraud, but she's fighting off that, and she's already sort of building a reputation for these sort of signs and wonders, if you will. Do you believe she produced a teacup?
You know, I wasn't there, so I can't tell you. But you know what? The teacup is in the archives at the Theosophical Society at Adyar. Everybody who went to this picnic claimed that, you know, this thing was produced. Now, the question of how she produced it, that's the real crux.
Okay.
And of course, there are people who are going to debate this. You know, we could be here till...
I'm asking you. I'm asking you. I'm not asking about other people.
Yeah.
Do you believe that somebody walked up to her and said, okay, produce a teacup, and she produced a teacup that was found in, you know, in the roots of a tree in a nearby woods? Do you believe that she did that?
That's what the record tells us.
No, what do you believe?
I tell you, no, my belief, you'll find, is exactly what William Butler Yeats said after meeting her. She is simply a mark of interrogation. She is a big question mark to me.
Okay, fair enough. So good. Thank you for that. I had to dig a little bit.
In turn, those things are not the things I'm looking at. I'm looking at what is contained in these books, and then in turn, what's the influence of that?
You know, I understand that, yeah. And I also understand human nature, yeah. And the there are people that I respect, whose work I respect, who still were given to the occasional indulgence mm-hmm. that I don't respect.
Yes,
and so
yes.
if as a matter of flourish, she did the teacup thing because she was trying to prove a point, and it might have gotten a point that became got out of hand. And so it comes down to us as sort of this historical question mark.
Yes, good point. Yeah, that's a very good point.
I'm okay with that, but I also don't believe she produced a teacup. So, I mean, I'm sort of like, I look at that, I
now,
go, okay.
Now we come into this particular question. You know, in the East, the tangible world is the unreal world, and as you move toward the intangible world, that's the real world. Now, these people had a perception that something happened. So whether she did it through suggestion or a physical teacup,
right.
You know, they experienced the thing.
It no, I totally get
to
that.
Them.
I totally get that, and
yeah.
we'll leave it there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, all right, so now she writes The Secret Doctrine. What year is she actually writing The Secret Doctrine?
She's, you know, so here she leaves India in disgrace, settles in this little town in Germany, Würzburg, Germany, in the middle of nowhere, and sits down at the end of 1885, spends most of 1886 writing this book, and finally moves to London at the beginning of 1887, which is in May. And the manuscript of The Secret Doctrine is now over 3 feet high.
But it almost kills her.
Yes, it almost kills her.
Talk about that.
Yes, yeah, she's, you know, there's this famous story, and I include it in the introduction to this abridgment of The Secret Doctrine, where she's been working on the book, and she starts to become comatose. Her health begins to fail, and they really, you know, she's, imagine her workday is 12 hours. She gets up in the morning about 7 or 8, has a cup of coffee, and sits down and writes till about 7 or 8 at night. That's her schedule for about a year. And her health suddenly, you know, she gets comatose. They send for a doctor from London. He does what he can. They feel that her condition is such that she actually is going to die. They decide to bring in the doctor, a lawyer, and the American consul as a witness to come and, you know, see her the next day just to make out this will. And during the night, the person who's with her finds that she actually just loses consciousness, and they really think she's gone. And the next day when the lawyer, the doctor, and the American consul come, there she is awake, and she says that she's been given the chance to die or finish The Secret Doctrine.
Wait, that's not the whole story. She's given the right, given the opportunity to die and be free the pain that she's experiencing.
Yes. Her life was not a wonderful, happy life. She didn't make any money off this, and, you know, she lived a very sort of, she really was consumed with this writing, this thing she wanted to communicate.
But she had sort of physical and then, you know, kind of psychic pain from producing this work. And
yes,
she says that they give her the choice. You can be free of the pain mm-hmm. and die, or accept the pain again and live to see this work finished and follow through.
Yes, very
okay.
true. Your research is good. Research.
I'm curious about that, because I think that you know, it. I can see where that would be a temptation. If she had that kind of, you know, kind of sort of, you know, looking at the light at the end of the tunnel sort of moment, mm-hmm. And she makes the choice to go back. Now, but it doesn't mean she's going to live a long life, though.
No, of course. The Secret Doctrine gets published in 1888. And by 1891, she's dead on the eve of her 59th birthday, almost 60.
What does she die of?
Probably overwork. There's an influenza epidemic. You know, we're all terrified now of this swine flu and these different flus, which are no laughing matter at that time. You know, during the Spanish flu, just around World War I, you know, 14 million people died of influenza.
So weakened condition plus lots of viruses in the air.
Yeah, and maybe she had just sort of been used up. Maybe she figured that, you know, she said everything she had to say, and maybe she was free.
In sports, we would say she left it all on the floor, right? She left it all on the court. And she didn't have anything left. So that's where we'll leave it for the moment, and then we'll come back then. What are the secret teachings in the secret doctrine? What is it that she discovered through all of these travels that she had to get down on paper and even die from in giving birth to it? The secret doctrine. We'll get into the actual history of humankind, the origins of the universe, and so much more next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.